Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus, or just go drop in and have something good to eat.
There you go. Well, like I said, this is KHOI Community Radio, and this last weekend, we had quite a shindig here at the radio station. It was KHOI's 7th birthday, 7th count. We've been here 7 years and still kicking. I think we're doing pretty good. And there was a fine gathering here on a rather warm but pleasant afternoon. And we had a Beatles tribute band playing. And if everybody in that audience didn't know all the words to sing along, we just had the greatest time. It was good. Good old Beatles music. And happy birthday to KHOI. So today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to be talking about language and the environment. How do we communicate with each other?
Yes, in our studio, we have a guest, Professor Dara Wald. She's the assistant professor in the Greenlee School of Communication at ISU. She's also a specialist in environmental communication, and she is working at ISU on something called the Science Communication Project. And she also teaches something called risk communication, which is what we want to know. Since Lana and I are communicators, we want to know how to communicate the risks that we see without projecting our own personal anxiety into the conversation. So, Dara, what do we do?
Well, that's a big question to start with. Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I think, you know, as you said, I focus on environmental communication and a little bit on science communication and risk communication, which are kind of spokes that come out of that. I think one of the things that we need to think more about is what are the causes and the consequences of public debate over these sometimes controversial, often complex environmental science and even risk-related topics.
Well, actually, even in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, there was an article about teaching environmental or climate-related things to children, and that some children had just become so traumatized because they were kind of taught it in a way that didn't help them kind of create a safe everyday reality. So that's, yeah, they need to know, but I think the recommendation was, well, first get them out in nature so that they understand nature first and foremost, and then you can talk about some things. But You've got young kids. What do we do?
I mean, I think getting everybody out in nature is a really important point, right? How do you value something that you've never seen, right? If you've never seen a tree, or if you've never seen an animal or a bird in flight, how do you know that it's? How do you know what to even feel about it? Right?
That's kind of hard for us in Iowa to even imagine, not having seen any of those things. But there are large parts of urban areas all over the globe where they really hardly have trees or...
Right. And what's amazing about urban systems is they still have a wonderful environment that you can teach kids about. I think often we think, oh, well, we need to get them out into a pristine or wild landscape. But I would suggest that in everyone's community, there are beautiful things. And
there's birds usually everywhere.
There's
insects everywhere.
Absolutely. And those are interesting and unique. And if we can get kids and adults, I think, of all ages to experience what the environment is, even if that environment looks really different in urban, let's say, Chicago or Des Moines compared to more rural parts of Iowa. I still think that's a wonderful, valuable thing. And so, yeah, I think we need to get people outside. I think that's a big part of it. And I think one of the things that often environmental communication folks have done is that they focus on some of those negative stories. But I think it's equally important to focus on the really positive stories, too, and to inspire awe and excitement in kids and adults. But also, I think it's important to talk about what you can do, right? And to not get bogged down into these conversations about all of the really difficult environmental challenges that we're facing. We do have a lot of environmental challenges, and I think there are really hardworking people who are working on these challenges from a variety of angles. And so I think that as communicators, we could spend a little bit more time, you know, talking about those folks and those successes that we are having in the environmental world, and then also trying to give people actual concrete actions.
I'm going to be
behaviors.
The cynic here.
Name a few of these positive environmental changes.
I think there are some really great agricultural examples of people who are doing really creative things, like the Iowa Learning Farms, where you're getting farmers and people together to talk about what land is and what it looks like. I think the Prairie Strips Project at Iowa State is a really great one, where they're getting people to think about land in a different way and what they can do on their farm and their community and mm-hmm. on their landscape. I think there are fantastic organic and community farms around Ames that are doing great work. And I think even though, again, environment looks different on a farm than it does out in a more wild or rural area, I should say wild rather than rural, but I still think that there is a value in getting people out to experience what that landscape looks like and the diversity that our landscapes do have, whether it's in an urban or a rural area.
Well, we should probably mention Practical Farmers of Iowa here, sure. too, because they have a lot of field trips mm-hmm. to farms all over the state of Iowa, demonstrating a lot of these things that you've just mentioned. And you can go. You don't mm-hmm. have to be a farmer to go. You don't even have to be a member to go. But you can get you and or your children out to see some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And there's a spectrum, right? There are horticultural gardens, there's Ryman mm-hmm. gardens, there are mm-hmm. other places in the state where you have really managed systems, and there are systems where you have this inner agricultural environmental mm-hmm. intersection on farms. And then there's really native, wild, protected areas that we also have, right? Where you can go for a hike or go kayak or do something in nature in a different way. And so I think all of those different kinds of environmental engagement can be really important. But I'd also say that that finding ways to get people to do behavior that is both sustainable and also benefits both, you know, your own learning and your kids' learning, but also benefits the environment is a really key step that I think we sometimes forget when we focus on all the challenges that we have.
That's true. There's the news that we receive when you think of the planet on the whole, part of it's burning up. The other part is drowning mm-hmm. people. And we're seeing so much populations not being able to stay in their home countries anymore mm-hmm. for political but environmental reasons, too. And all these things seem too big. I mean, there is a crisis. And how we deal with that, how we get that into our mind is really important, because the changes we want to make here in Iowa on our own farms, in our own backyards, we can't really divorce ourselves from that. I want to get back to talking to kids about environment. No matter what age, kids are aware of what's going on. There's if we haven't heard by now, of course, there's this young, lovely young woman, kid, Greta Thunberg from Scandinavia someplace. But she has just been talking truth to power all over the place about the future of our planet. That seems to be an awful heavy load for someone her age with her two long braids standing there in front of a microphone.
She's like about 16 or something like that.
Yeah. I think it's amazing that she seems to take this sort of thing on. That means that kids at that age, or maybe even younger, can deal with big issues.
Absolutely.
And it seems like her voice is, we have to. It's my future. It's our future. She's an amazing, amazing person. And the thing is, kids can ask. They turn to us as adults, and they expect us to act as adults. We try. There's a lot of us try.
There's a lot of things
that we bring to the table when we discuss the environment, because you end up with, oh, but it's my land. Oh, but it's we've always done it that way. There's so many reasons to not change. You deal with communicating. How do you get people at the table to discuss openly and change their mind?
Well, great question. So to go back to the example of the little girl that you mentioned, I think one of the things that is really important to think about with environmental communication is who is your messenger, and what are the characteristics of that messenger? And is this person the best person to be describing this particular message, right? And in the case of the little girl that you described, right, one of the reasons why she's probably successful and appealing is because she's from an age group that is, you know, she's seen as innocent and not really invested in she's invested in the future, but she's not politically invested in the sense that she's not from a corporation that whose bottom line depends on, you know, the success or failure of a particular policy. Mm-hmm. And so she's seen as an innocent messenger. She's perceived as trustworthy. She's perceived as credible because it's her future that she's talking about without any financial gain to herself. And so one of the things that I think a lot about in my research with communication is who is the source? Who is the person who is voicing the message? And one of the things that we often see in my area of research is that different sources have a different legitimacy. They have a different level of credibility. And so if you're a scientist who works for a particular industry, you're going to have a different level of perceived credibility than a scientist who works for a government organization or for an academic institution. And of course, how you perceive yourself may not always be exactly how the people you're trying to send your message to, how they perceive you. And so we do certainly need to think about the sources, and the example of the little girl that you provided was a great one. The other thing to think about is, what is your messenger saying? What are the words that they're using? Are they using value statements? Are they talking about their emotions, right? One of the things that's often challenging when you're talking about scientists trying to communicate to the public is that often scientists use numbers and data, right? We rely on the scientific method to ask questions. And so when we present our results, we often talk about numbers and data, and we walk through the uncertainty, right? Here's what we think we know. Here's the confidence interval. And that's a very different way of speaking compared to this little girl, right, who might be talking about how she feels and what she values and what she wants her future to be. Those are messages that are more grounded in her own personal experiences, her values, her emotions, and also her hopes and her dreams. And so you end up with the situation often where two sources are really communicating in a different way, using different terminology, using different kinds of messages.
Like apples and oranges, right?
And so how could you possibly get people to come to the table and even hear each other, let alone agree on something and move forward if you're talking about apples and oranges, as Donna said?
Is there a way to do that? My goodness. We were talking earlier about, well, science. You mentioned corporate scientists and university science. And then there's this thing, I read it on Facebook. It must be true. Common knowledge now has got so many different compartments to it. So when we hear words about climate, the future, statistics, who does one believe?
I think that's where trust comes in and why trust is such an important concept. One of the things that I have read a lot about or seen a lot of headlines about is sort of we're in this era of where there's no truth, right? It's not a fact-driven era anymore. And I would actually suggest that I think that the general public is pretty savvy in reading Facebook. I think I've certainly done interviews where people have said time and time again, like, oh, yeah, I'll look at something because it's on Facebook, but I don't necessarily trust it until I figure out who the source is, right? Who is this person who's posting it and what is their agenda? And so I do think while people are rely very heavily on their own beliefs. They also rely very heavily on their own level of trust and perceptions of the trustworthiness of other individuals. And so I think that it is up to us as scientists, as practitioners, as communicators, to be honest and open both about what our own biases are, what our goals are. I think scientists often start by talking about their awards often, right, or their degrees, or their institutions where they come from, or the grants that they've received. And all of that stuff is really important and definitely resonates with an academic audience. But I would like to also hear scientists talk about why they got into science in the first place, right? If you want someone to understand who you are, I think your story is really an important part of explaining that. And I would love to see scientists talk more about their own personal journeys and why they do what they do, and also what they believe and what their own biases are, because I think that's a really important point. I think all of us are human, no matter what our occupations are. I think it's important to talk about why you're doing the work that you're doing and where it comes from. So part of it, I think, in bringing people together is to understand each other, to understand your own biases as well as the person who's across the table from you.
So in your science communication project, is this something you're working on, helping the scientists to be more personal and emotive in their languaging?
So,
well, good luck. That's fantastic.
So one of the projects that I'm working on with my collaborators at Iowa State is this idea of trying to figure out, you know, what do scientists actually do when they give these public presentations, and is it effective? And so I've got a project right now looking at speakers who've come to the university where we actually survey the audience before and after the talk. And then we also look at what the speaker is doing. Do they put up images? Do they use humor? Do they use value-based language? Do they make a lot of hand gestures? Do they acknowledge where their funding sources come from? Some of these questions, as well as, like, are they engaged? Are they, you know, honest? Things like that. And one of the things that we'd like to see when the project concludes is sort of what was the effect of some of this stuff that we think is supposed to be effective in science communication? Is it truly effective? And if it is, does it actually influence perceived trust? Is going to a scientific talk actually influence your perception of the trustworthiness of a scientist? Or are you already really high on trustworthiness? And so giving a scientific talk at the university is certainly valuable for your audience because they're going to be motivated and excited to hear you talk. But maybe it's not going to shift trustworthiness as much as it would if you were to give a talk at the airport or at the Iowa State Fair or to an audience where they've never engaged with a scientist before in that way, potentially. And so these are some of the questions that we're trying to answer with the Science Communication Project. And we're in the second year of that project right now.
That's true. The results of all the data that is collected, all of the testing that goes on, it is used, it may just be a pile of numbers, but those are important numbers. Mm-hmm. And we think, oh, that doesn't matter. But that stuff ends up being policy, food policy, environmental policy. And it's important that we listen to this stuff and know what's going on.
Do you think that scientists are not taught to kind of know their audience before they, like, I'll say in the food world, if you're doing an event or something like that, you have to know your audience. You have to know what their expectations are so you don't give them something too spicy or too this or too, you want to hit the point where they will be the most receptive to what you are producing. Is that not true in science?
That's absolutely true in science. I think one of the challenges for science communication training is that it is hard to get expertise in both your field, right? You need to learn your statistics. You need to learn the terminology. You need to take class after class in how to be an expert in your field, your own field, right? Whether that's agronomy or economics or engineering, right? And then on top of that, we are now asking scientists to also be experts in the field of communication, which has
or at least literate in the field. Okay.
Right. But either way, that takes an enormous amount of time.
And but it's really, really important.
I completely agree. It is incredibly important and fundamental. And the question is, I think that and I think academic institutions are struggling with this, right? How do you do both well? How do you get students who are experts and specialists in their discipline, but also understand both the value of communicating science and have the ability to do it? And I think this is one of the ways in which interdisciplinary collaboration is really important, right? I am not going to be an expert in environmental engineering. I was not trained to be an expert in environmental engineering. I was trained to be an expert in environmental communication. But I can have a really productive collaboration with an engineer who is trained in that area, but I can be the science communication specialist. And that's where I think those interdisciplinary collaborations are fundamentally important. And I do think, you know, I would maybe 10 years ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would have said, I don't think universities are thinking about it. But now I think that universities are thinking about it and they're struggling with how to do it.
Well, all I can say is, oh, shoo, that is a good thing. That is really, I mean, there are, of course, science writers who happen to be really, really good writers, but not a lot of them, not enough of them, not especially when we need them now.
Right. And I teach science communication, and I have a great mix of students. I'm teaching it this fall. I have a great mix of students who are scientists and students who are journalists, and I have some grad students in the class too. And that's one of the things that I walk them through is like, what is the theory of science communication? How do you do it well? And then we practice and practice, and they write lots and lots of stories over the course of the semester with the hope that it would be like an introduction that they could then continue on in their careers building those skills. The other thing I would say is that there are, for scientists who are really interested in this, there are awesome opportunities around the country and at Iowa State to be involved in science communication. There are programs like the Story Collider where they try to get scientists to tell their story about what they've experienced and who they are and why they do what they do.
What medium is that?
The Story Collider? Uh-huh. It's a radio program. Mm. But they also do visits. Like we had one.
Is that like an NPR thing or something?
I think it's on NPR, yeah. And they did a visit at Iowa State just, I think it was last year, and one of my grad students actually did a talk and was part of that, but several of the faculty members at Iowa State and I think a few staff folks.
So Bill Nye does not have to be the only science superstar on the planet.
No, absolutely not. and I think there's some great examples in other places too for how to be a practitioner of science communication and also a scientist. And there's new data too. I think for a long time scientists were hesitant to be perceived as advocates. Right, because science is supposed to be separate from advocacy. That's
true.
A line I heard a lot for many, many years as a graduate student. Right, mm-hmm. Where is that line? How do you know if you're a scientist or an advocate? Right, we shouldn't be advocating for policy. And I think scientists are starting to sort of really explore that question and challenge that question. Right, and there's been some really interesting studies to look at what happens when scientists do communicate and if the response to that is a lack of perceived credibility and legitimacy or not, right? In many cases, some of the data, and right now we're sort of on the cusp of answering some of these questions, and so the data is mixed, right? In some cases, in some approaches, you can threaten your legitimacy or credibility if you're perceived as too much of an advocate, but in other cases, it doesn't seem to make much of a difference, and we're trying to figure that out.
The question of advocacy also can be, you know, like if we're going to talk about science, climate change, there are people advocating that we need to pay more attention. There are also people advocating that it's no big deal or mm-hmm. that it's not, that it's imagined. So advocacy does not always mean you're exposing something or speaking your truth. Sometimes the advocacy is created because the scientist is paid to say those things.
Sure. And the I think for many scientists, right, the concern is I don't want to be perceived as someone who is not credible because then nobody will read my work and people will question my results. And if I put myself out there too much, at what point do people stop listening to what I have to say? And that's definitely a fear that I hear from the scientists.
Do you think it's used as an intimidation tactic also?
Possibly, right? That fear of perceived
loss of funding, mm-hmm. loss of credibility.
Absolutely. And those are real, right? Like as a scientist, if you can't fund your students and you can't fund your scholarship, you know, you're not going to go very far as a scientist. We are at that point. And so thinking about where that line is and what it means to be an advocate and you know, just, I mean, just as journalists think about this, right? As journalists, we need to, when we write and we quote somebody, we need to attribute that source, right? We need to, and we can't fabricate quotes, right? They have to be from real people who really said those things, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a way that journalists protect themselves and say, like, look, this is a credible source. This is credible information, right? And so it's not unique to scientists to worry about this. Lots of other fields think about it. I think the challenge becomes where, at what point do you advocate for a policy that you know is right and you know that the science and the data support this as
being and you've done your research.
Absolutely.
You're right.
Absolutely.
Whether the scientist has done his research or the journalist has done, you know, their other kind of research. These are really important questions. I mean, yeah. I just know in our reporting on the Donalana Kitchen, both of us do a lot of research. We read and read and read and research and who said what and what does this mean? And and I feel like we try to use this platform of our radio station to kind of graze through the whole field of, you know, cooking, nutrition, health, food policy, environmental policy, and bring the really cogent things to people who don't have the time or the skill level to do the research.
It's true. You're listening to KHOI. This is Tasty Radio, Donalana Kitchen. Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're at the kitchen table today with Dara Wald. She's a professor at Iowa State in the Greenlee School of Journalism. And she's talking about the language of risk and the language of how we talk about what's going on in the sciences and the environment and the climate. These are the term hot button is maybe overused, but these terms, they need to be discussed rationally, not just emotionally, although things do hit our emotions quite a bit.
Well, you know, and an example, and we come across this in Iowa, and I think Lana and I try really important, you know, as good Midwestern ladies, we do not want to be polarizing. You know, we want to love our neighbors as ourselves and all of that, which we were brought up to and firmly believe in that. So when we live in a community where if you say climate change, some people have a certain reaction, but you can talk about the weather patterns. I mean, what is the most effective language to try to understand what's going on with the wet springs that we had, for example, and, you know, what are we supposed to do about all this? And how are we supposed to talk to our neighbor in ways that are inclusive and are meaningful?
I think one of the first things you do is you listen, right? What are the things that your neighbor is really concerned about? And if it happens to be the flooding of their fields, then you talk about what they are struggling with and what they can do about the flooding of the fields. And I don't think that has to be necessarily a conversation about climate change or whether climate change is man-made or not. It can be a conversation about what are you struggling with? What are your concerns? How do we address them, right? On the practical level, first and foremost, because I don't think it really is. I think sometimes we get bogged down in this debate about climate change and we move away from practical, everyday conversations about there's too much water on my landscape. What can I do about it in a way that is sustainable? And I think,
right, and so that the water does not carry away all of my topsoil, for example.
Absolutely, or doesn't, you know, run into streams, right? And we get problems with nitrates. So I think one of the problems that I often see in the way that we communicate is that we get into these little boxes of identity and we start getting into this us or them language and it becomes this bigger, larger, more polarized debate, which I think is an important conversation. I think we should be talking to people on different sides of the political aisle, on different sides of the urban-rural divide. I think we should be talking to people who are different from us. And I think only through listening, more than just talking, right, can we really truly start to hear a different perspective. And I think that's one of the valuable things for me, at least, of living in a state that I think of as a purple state, right? It's a state where we have lots of people from different political walks of life. And
these are our neighbors.
Right. But I think too often we get into this thing where we separate ourselves from people who feel differently from us, because it is hard to have those conversations, right? When you have a conversation with someone who has very different values and beliefs and attitudes than you do, it can challenge you, right? Especially if those values and attitudes and beliefs are tied up in your own identity, in your own social groups, right? You worry about, well, if I have this opinion, am I not going to have my social group anymore? Is my social group going to ostracize me? Am I going to be outside of it? And so I do think it's really important for us to flex those muscles of communicating with someone who feels differently, reading a news source that you're not used to reading, right? Trying to challenge yourself is the only way you're going to get that sort of flexibility in those muscles to be able to hear things that come from a different perspective or different values or beliefs.
Well, sometimes I think the underlying values, of course, we all value having a healthy neighborhood for our children to grow up in. You know, there are where we get lost is somewhere in the language around it.
Yeah, there's a great concept that we all have these different sort of moral values, right? So yes, we care about having a healthy community for our children to grow up in. But some of us, when we talk about that, we frame it as a care or harm moral position. So we care about healthy neighborhoods because we want our children to be, you know, they're innocent and we want to protect them and we care about them and we love them, right? But we also could frame it as a security issue, right? That we want our kids to be free and we want them to have the security of knowing that their community is safe. Mm-hmm. And it's a justice issue. It's their right to do that, right? And those two
everyone wants that.
Yes, I would say that everyone wants that underlying value of a safe community, but not everybody frames it in the same way. And that framing, that idea that you could make an argument that is about liberty or justice or freedom, is a very different kind of argument than, at least according to the Moral Foundation's theory, is a very different argument than this care versus harm foundation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we get into these situations where we frame things in a different way. And then we also have to understand that that framing, that resonates with different groups of our audience, right? So some people really, really connect with that care harm foundation, and some people really connect with that liberty and justice foundation. And
that's true. A good community, a value judgment, a good community for some might be a gated community mm-hmm. where I am safe, my children. Yeah, for somebody else, you're on the freedom and justice side community. Mm-hmm. And when people say a good community, well, we better talk about what we mean by that.
Right. And then those things get wrapped up in identity, right? And they get wrapped up in social networks, just like I was talking about before, these social groups. And then, oh, the person who is thinking about it this way, well, they're outside of my group. But this person over here who's worried about care and harm, they're really a part of my group. And so I can't agree with this other person over here because it doesn't conform to my identity. It might make me a social outcast. And so that's where social norms and community identity and identity, social identity becomes really important. Mm-hmm. That's where we escalate that conflict, right? And those controversies.
Oh, yes. We're working into people identifying with the season is coming, folks. The political signs things aren't always that simple. They should be a point of a start of discussion.
Yes, they're not red or blue, as Dara said. They really usually are kind of purple.
kind of purple.
Yeah. So Dara, you teach a graduate class that's actually called Risk Communication.
Yeah.
Those are some heavy words. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, so it's actually, we start out, the first half of the class is all about perceptions of risk. So let's take something like wind energy. Right? So some people perceive wind turbines as something that is really beneficial for the environment. It provides jobs. It provides energy. Some people also who live next to wind turbines have been concerned about the potential health-related risks of wind energy and wind turbines in particular. And in fact, last night on KCCI, there was a story about how Marion County, the health board in Marion County has just come out with new, I think it was a proclamation about how close wind turbines should be sited to property lines. And then in particular in the story, they cited concerns over the health-related impacts wind turbines. And they cited in the story a scientist saying there's no peer-reviewed research that suggests that there are health-related impacts of wind energy and wind turbines. And this is an example, right, of where you have different stakeholders, different groups of individuals who are invested in the outcome of this conversation, what's going to happen with wind in their community.
So in this case, science was evoked, but the science does actually not exist.
Right. So there is no peer-reviewed research that suggests that there are any health-related impacts of wind. Yet many individuals, and I have a student who's worked with individuals who she's interviewed, who have actually said, like, I really – like, this wind turbines moved in. My neighbor put up wind turbines, and they were put too close to my house. And it's creating all these health-related impacts for me. My family couldn't sleep. I had to move off my farm. Like, we've heard anecdotal evidence of this. And so the question in risk communication that we explore is, well, if the science says there's no risk – but individuals have experienced what they think is a risk, and they have these very strong perceptions and beliefs of a risk, then one of the arguments I make is that it's still something that we need to talk about. It's still something that we need to acknowledge and listen to.
Well, and perhaps we need to do more science on that subject.
And perhaps we need more science on that subject, right?
It's a fairly new phenomena, given the mm-hmm. long history of science.
Yeah. And so the risk communication class is all about examples of things like that, where they sit at this intersection of science and society, and some people perceive it as risky and other people don't. And so what do you do? What are the different kinds of communication that you can have? Now, some things, like in the health world, are we understand and generally they're accepted. Like, we generally accept that smoking is a health risk now.
But that wasn't always true.
Exactly. So we talk about that. We talk about these different in the case of smoking today, we're in care communication. We're in this situation where people understand and believe that smoking is a problem. And so we have a different form of communication than what we're in with climate change or vaccines, where we have, you know, controversy around these topics. And so we're in a different kind of communication where we have to really bring people to the table and have these one-on-one conversations so that we can come to solutions and also continue to do more science and more research to support our findings, even though the consensus among the scientific community is that climate change is happening, it's man-made, and that vaccines are really important to protect the health of our communities. So even then, we need to still, because there are these groups that are concerned about that, we still need to acknowledge those concerns, talk about them, have conversations about them, and continue to present, I think, the science and the data when we have it.
Well, and one can understand, given, you know, even the history of the last 50 or 60 years, like in food science, One day margarine will be great and butter is terrible.
Exactly.
Well, you know, 10 years later, actually, oops, we were wrong about the science in this. And the same thing as we use smoking is a good example. I mean, yeah, science, you know, once we study it for a longer period. Now, there is the precautionary principle.
Sure.
Oh, talk about that. Yes.
Yeah, so one of the things that's really important to remember in risk communication is that risk is culturally defined and described, meaning in some cultures, certain things are very perceived as, you know, taboo or not something we talk about or perceived as more risky than other activities. And so the precautionary principle is something that is often used in Europe, and it's how Europe sort of has gone about how they regulate genetically modified foods, as they've said, well, if there is the potential for risk, we're going to take a precautionary stance and ban it or prevent it because we think that the potential for risk is so high, even if the science does not necessarily always tell us that
we don't know yet.
Or we don't
know
or the science is uncertain.
There is a story I think we've told on the radio. One of the Japanese agricultural ministers was visiting an organic grain company in Illinois, and then they were invited by Monsanto to come to see, you know, because it's in St. Louis, come and see. So the trade minister goes and he's looking at everything and he goes, yes, right, but this is really remarkable. Please call me in 30 years' time when you have proven this technology on a generation and a half. Mm-hmm. It's very impressive, but in Japan, we're going to wait and see how this all pans out. That is the precautionary principle.
Yeah. And so in the United States, we are less risk averse than that. So in the United States,
we jump first and look later.
We generally jump first and yes, and look later. That's a good way of describing it. And so in the United States, we generally operate on not under the precautionary principle and more under the principle of we're going to try this and see what happens.
There's a part that goes with it because that technology is very American. A lot of major corporations have made a lot of money on that. And so there's a big financial push to, like, you know, buy now and pay later. And I can see why people question these things.
Yeah. And I think, again, it goes back to this idea that risk communication has to acknowledge that risk perceptions are inherently subjective. Right. Uh-huh. Your perception of a risk has to do with your culture. It has to do with your identity. It has to do with how much you trust that source. It has to do with your lived experiences. Right.
Absolutely.
And so your perception doesn't always and in most cases doesn't just have to do with what you read in the scientific article. Right. And in some cases, your risk perception might even have to do with what your friend who happens to be a scientist, even though they're a scientist in a different field, happened to say. Right. And so we have to remember that if a perception is there, even if the science is not certain at this point in time, you have to acknowledge that that perception is there and it's worth both acknowledging it, listening to it, and addressing it, because otherwise.
And being cognizant of one's own personal biases.
Absolutely.
For example, back to the butter.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was growing up, I came from dairy farming families. My father was in the dairy business. And when margarine came along, we did not eat that, right? We just kept eating our butter. No matter what, we did not believe in margarine. And it was a belief system. Well, fortunately, it turned out that the science later reversed itself. But we just kept eating butter because we were a dairy farming family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, yeah. I still eat a lot of butter.
And I'd imagine at that time, right, you probably heard the science suggesting that butter was bad for you. And you said, I'm gonna stick with my butter, right? Because this is what I believe. This is what I'm comfortable with. This is my lived experience. This is my family identity.
Frankly, I thought it tasted better.
Well, it also probably
that
tasted.
That was a kind of easy decision, you know. The margarine didn't really taste so good, right?
Right, but that's part of your lived experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's a great example of where the science was telling you one thing and you went in this different direction. And so it's really important, I think, Lana, you said earlier, this idea that, like, sometimes people go off of their emotions and as opposed to their rational beliefs. And I'd like to suggest that we all have that capacity, right? We all have this capacity.
And I think it's a good thing.
And I think it's just the way we are, right? Yeah. We have this emotional component to us, which I've also heard described as like our elephant, right? and we have this rational response to things, which is our rider, right? And sometimes we can keep that elephant in check. We can hold on to those emotions, especially mm-hmm. if it's not something that challenges our identity and it's not something we can listen to the rational scientific evidence. But sometimes that elephant takes over and it doesn't really matter what your writer tries to do, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what your rational side tells you. You're going to go with that lived, emotional, vibrant experience,
well,
right?
But the yeah. elephant also is what makes us empathetic beings. It's so. Very important
and
it, to be
yes,
empathetic.
And it's good to know that you're trying to get the humanity back into the sciences so we can talk better with each other. We've been talking to Dara Wald. From ISU, and we've been talking about risk and the environment and how we talk about these things. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org and support this fine radio station. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about language and science and the humanities. I have something not related really to any of those, but this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and things show up on our kitchen table every now and then. I was given a bowl full of these wonderful things by a friend, and he said, here, I got these from my mom in New Mexico, and I'm going to make some mead out of them. What are you going to do with them? I received a nice bowl full of purple prickly pear cactus fruit. Who would think? Cactus.
Prickly is a good word.
Prickly is good. Pear cactus fruit. It's a purple thing. It grows on what you might consider a very nasty looking cactus. And they grow very well in many, many parts of the country. I looked this up, and there are 181 species of prickly pear cactus. And on the top of these pads of the prickly pears that grow all different sorts of shapes and sizes and heights, you get these little fruits this time of year in the late summer. And one can order them online. You can get them in grocery stores and things. They're
about 2 inches
yeah.
tall by an inch and a half wide.
They're also called, I remember once we ran across this purple-looking, knobbly little thing, and it was called dragon fruit. I could see why it's called dragon fruit. So I looked up what we should do with this. I think I'm going to make some jelly out of this stuff. If you're collecting these prickly pears.
Not in Iowa.
No. Beware. Beware, they have prickles on them. So you do have to use gloves, and you can burn or
scrape.
Bake off the prickles and then cut them apart. And the insides, so I hear tell, are
oh, we're going to cut one
very
open. We are going to, ooh, they're pretty. They are deep purple with little seeds.
Yeah, sort of kiwi-ish looking on the inside. But I'm looking forward to turning those into jelly. My friend Ben is going to make some mead. We'll be comparing notes. And Dara, you
watch
said...
Watch out for the seeds.
Dara, you know what these are. I've been asking people what these are. You know. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we used to grow them before we moved to Iowa, we lived in Arizona, and I worked at Arizona State. And before that, we lived in Florida. And prickly pear cactus grow in both places. And in fact, when we were in Florida, we just a friend brought over a pad of the cactus for us, and we planted in our yard with very little effort. And within a year or two, we had this humongous cactus with these beautiful magenta fruits all over them.
And you can eat the leaves, too. They're called nopales.
Yes, yes. You can roast them, I believe, and they are also they grow in desert climates really well, and they're an acquired taste, but once you try it, I think you'll enjoy it.
See, it's nice to know there's food growing all over if we just know where to look. I'm going to use the insides of this prickly pear cactus fruit and add some sugar and lemon. I'm going to see if I can make myself some jelly out of this or some jam. I think that's I would be very good. It's nice to get new food every now and then. And I hear tell that there are 3 or 4 native Iowa prickly pear cactus plants that grow here in very dry places. And yes, they do fruit. Not as big as this. Just little end of your thumb kind of fruits. But there you are. There you are. It's always nice to try new things. Yeah, I can see why it's called dragon fruit. Prickly pear jelly. Stay tuned, folks. We'll do that. I also want to mention the Iowa State Fair is going on. I didn't go this year. Did you go, Dar?
Not yet, but we're hoping to.
Very good. We wish you a good
Take
day for
children
that.
Children down to see the animals.
Yeah. Oh, it's always good stuff to go down there. And I just want to mention, they always make such a big deal of the winners of the new food that you can buy down there. There's always things on sticks. This year, the 2019 Best Deal winner is Cookies and Cream Wonder Bar. I can see that. Ice cream. Cookies and Cream Wonder Bar. Huh?
Okay.
That sounds good.
I don't think
good.
I'm going to drive down just to taste one, though.
Hand-cut cookies and cream ice cream is dipped in chocolate, then rolled in crushed Oreo pieces. Huh? Get everything all at once.
Is it deep-fried, then?
I don't think you deep-fry
Wonder Bar. Oh, thank goodness.
No, probably not. Probably not. Okay, and here's 3 other ones. Georgie's Roast with the Most. It is a chorizo sausage crumbles, roasted green chili on a beef pot roast. Ah, very good.
Chorizo on a beef pot roast? How Iowan. Okay.
It's a wrap.
A wrap.
The Chief at the Rib Shack, a slow-smoked beef brisket with cilantro, lime slaw, and salsa cream. Ah, that's pretty good. And Chicken Street Tacos, grilled chicken covered
with
fresh salsa.
Three Mexican-influenced dishes at the Iowa State Fair. Yeah, all right.
Isn't that something?
Let's hear it for the immigrants. Hello.
Everybody's
kind of... They won the prizes this year.
Talking about that sort of thing. Good.
Sounds like something you would eat with prickly pear cactus.
I guess, Dara, I think that's another example of... Using food, using the words of food to kind of get images going in our brain. How we talk about food, how we talk about the fair. It's a mystical sort of central Iowa phenomenon, this Iowa State Fair. We do make a big deal out of it, don't we?
You do, but it's great. I think a fair is a great example of bringing people from all sorts of walks of life and political beliefs together. And I think...
Eat the food, look at the animals,
food, right?
How nice.
To look at animals, to do things that aren't politically or just expressly politically motivated, right? It's an example to meet your neighbors, as Donna said before, how important that is, and to build community around something as lovely as food. And I think that's a great way of
that's true.
Bringing
and
people together.
That's been going on for a long time. One of my favorite things is just to go to the administration building, which has this lovely big porch, and sit on the porch and eat something on a stick. But just watch Iowa walk by and you live here. I live here, too. It's a pretty good thing, I think. Yes, I do. So I want to mention... We are right in the middle of August. And August, you hate to go by without mentioning that this is the time of the harvest, the first fruits. And from my ever handy...
The best corn.
Yeah, everything harvesting. From my ever-handy pagan book of days. This is the time of the Irish Festival of Lunasa, of gathering and making merry because the garden, the fields, the farms are producing. That's a good reason to celebrate.
Because we're eating well.
We're eating well. Here's some words from that festival. Heaven, earth, sun, moon, and sea, fruits of earth and sea stuff, mouths, ears, eyes, possessions, feet, hands, and warrior tongues, all gathering around the fire. And also, lots of weather hints for August. But here's another one. Pale moon doth rain, red moon doth blow, white moon doth neither rain or snow. Of course, the likelihood of snow in August is almost nil. But I saw on the internet it's snowing in Australia. There was pictures of kangaroos in snow.
Oh, yeah, they don't usually have
don't
snow,
usually
I guess.
Get
oh,
that,
my.
But that's okay. Anyway.
Oh, my. Changing weather patterns.
Thanks to Dara Wald for being with us today. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen Tuesday at noon, repeats Tuesday at 7 p.m. in the evening, or anytime on khoifm.org. Music today by a fine young musician, Aaron O'Neill, and the O'Neill Family Band. They have Ames connections. They live in northern Minnesota now, but Tom and Jean O'Neill lived in Ames, Iowa for a long time. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We'll go out with written by Aaron O'Neill, called the Morning Dove Waltz. We had fine engineering by Cynthia McClure. Eat good food and enjoy life.